Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. This is an Empowerment Hour. This is 1 hour a week out of the 15 hours of live broadcasting that I do, where there are no guests, no in-depth original investigative reporting. Rather, it's talkback. You have an opportunity to share your thoughts, insights, points of view, questions, concerns. The number to call in throughout our hour is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. In the past 5 days, we've had some challenges, some hacking of our website. We've had some downtime. It's back up now. Though all of our archives and thousands of articles are gone, we'll put new ones up. And I have probably 6,000 articles in my own personal archive, over 600 of my own that we're going to be installing. Plus, we put about 100 articles a day on progressive problem-solving themes up. But one thing makes it very easy. If you ever have a problem getting onto the web, all you have to do is call. Just call a number and you can listen anywhere. And that's why I keep emphasizing this, for just the reason we had. We've had three issues recently. One, we simply had too many people coming, numbers that I simply would not have anticipated, but I didn't know I was on one of the most popular Christian broadcasting radio programs in America. I was on Talk About Genetic Engineering. We were overwhelmed with people wanting to get in and hear. And they share a lot of the same principles, a lot of the same values. You forget how many people are out there eating organic, want a cleaner environment, don't want genetic engineered foods, don't want unnecessary or harmful vaccines in their kids. These are things they wanted to hear about, and that's why they came on board. But so many, it kept a lot of our regular people from being able to get on. And it happened again with the enormous amount of PBS airings of a particular two new programs I have. So you can always pick up the phone and call this number and listen. You can go to the archives on this number. 619-550-0869. Write this down, please. 619-550-0869. Now, today, I'm going to give you a real in-depth understanding of your better brain with tryptophan. A lot of people don't know what tryptophan is. I'll share that with you. Some new information from Travis Harding. Also, the latest research on vitamin C and how you can maximize your intake of vitamin C. I'll also be giving you the newest information on ubiquitins, a potential for fighting disease. You may not have heard this tiny little protein called ubiquitin, but it's in every cell in the body. And cinnamon has some really wonderful disease-fighting properties. I'll share that, plus a lot more on health. From our environmental segment today, we're going to look at the water is running out in Gaza, and humanitarian catastrophe looms as territory's only aquifer fails. Now, we have our own water problems in the United States, and I've been covering them almost daily. But I also believe that we should look at other people's problems as well and what the solutions are. This is from Xander Swinburne and from Reuters, and I'll share this with you. Also, many people in this audience were concerned that our president was saying we want renewable energy, we're going to put a lot of investment in it. But where did he actually put the money? He put it right back into the same dirty, polluting energies. So I'm going to quote from the energy chief, U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, declaring, quote, coal is our future. And they're coming back to this lie that you can clean coal up. Clean coal, that's the idea. That's renewable. It's not. So I'll deal with that. There was a time when if you got a bad drug, you could sue. 80% of all medications today, if they injure you or kill you, you cannot sue. The Supreme Court rules drug companies are exempt from lawsuits. How'd that happen? Why didn't more people know about it? Also today, from our environmental segment. Do you remember I did about 4 special one-hour programs on Fukushima? I said we were being lied to, the radiation was worse. Today, the New York Times. Yes, it is. Fukushima radiation levels are 1,800% higher than anyone believed. Okay. Why is that important? Do you remember those thousands of workers who were working there, supposedly in a safe time limit? Then all those people are going to die. Who's going to help those people? Who's going to be honest with them? Who's going to tell their families, we lied? They've known this all along. They lie about everything in Japan when it comes to their government. They're just pathologically liars. Also today, Suffer the Children, from Dr. Marilyn Wedge. Why French kids don't have ADHD? Yeah, they don't. 0.5%, not even 0.5%. Well, look, in the United States, it's as high as 11 to 15% of boys. How'd that happen? We'll tell you what the French are doing, we're not. We've all heard the concept, we should recycle. Yes, we should. But, oh, is that an excuse to continue consuming, including amongst those individuals who are supposedly hip? Well, this is just part of the hypocrisy. George Monbiot from The Guardian on that. Let's begin. We all want to have a better brain chemistry. My whole next 6 months of touring a PBS special or specials on PBS stations and lots of sharing with scientists. I'll be doing a presentation at an international symposium for anti-aging scientists, is about how we can slow down the brain from aging, how we can reverse damage, how we can rejuvenate it, all of which are doable. But what we do know, and especially from Travis Harding's new work, is that aging is often accompanied by a spectrum of mood disorders. I'm sure you've all become familiar with that, where people get to a certain age, they become very contrary. They get moody. Now, in women, it's generally menopause. And just imagine that you want to be happy, you want to feel effervescent and upbeat and positive, but there's just something holding you back emotionally, and you can't put your finger on it. You just feel edgy, you feel anger, you feel despondent, irritable, stressed. Now, these symptoms, along with more severe ones like sleep disorders and depression and aggressive behavior and reduced motivation and suicidal thinking, have all been traced to a depletion of the brain chemical serotonin. That's a neurotransmitter. We also call it the happiness hormone. Now, with the progression of age, and also what most 95% of Americans do, they drink or eat foods or beverages that cause low or high levels of inflammation. That inflammation is what sets the stage for degenerative disease in almost every area of your body. Some people find it first in their joints, in their fingers and toes, swelling, pain in their musculature. But it's there. And while this inflammation often leads to diabetes and cancer and heart disease, before it does all that, it's affecting the brain. And that will interfere with the production and release of serotonin. Do you remember years ago when President Clinton had had his annual physical examination, and all the former presidents and current presidents have to have this, and generally they're given the examinations, extensive examinations by some of the finest physicians in America. He was given a clean bill of health. 3 weeks later, he was rushed in for triple bypass surgery to save his life. I said at the time, they missed it. Look at his diet. Look at his lifestyle. It was all in the inflammation. And it depends upon how inflammatory your lifestyle is as to when it will tip and what organ of the body will manifest it. But when they finally showed him rejuvenated on a healthier diet, I said, but the damage has already been done because what was inflaming the arteries and the heart, causing them damage, was also inflaming the brain. I predict that you'll see a diagnosis and a statement. It'll be delayed and denied until after Hillary becomes president, that he has Parkinson's or he has dementia, and leading quickly thereafter to Alzheimer's. I do not believe that any human being, not one on the planet, is able to have that much inflammation and not end up with advanced brain disease. Well, that's true of everyone. He's just an example of how they looked at the heart and said, oh, thank goodness we did this bypass. That didn't change anything. His lifestyle will, and that'll help him. But that inflammation was in the eyes, the brain, the lungs, the muscle, the kidneys, the liver, every system of the body, because it's carried in the blood. Anyhow, although you can't supplement with serotonin itself, tryptophan is a safe, well-proven supplement. And supplementing with tryptophan helps normalize levels of serotonin and other neurotransmitters. As a result, it can reverse many of the behavioral symptoms of age, including irritability, mood disorders, anxiety, and stress. And I've seen people literally turn around their emotional state after they've been doing this for a while. Now, here's what the authentic, voluminous, peer-reviewed scientific literature shows. Tryptophan helps regulate behavior. Tryptophan simply makes people nicer. And with the close connection between tryptophan and the neurotransmitter serotonin, it shouldn't be surprising that supplementing with tryptophan can regulate behaviors that involve serotonin signaling in the brain, such as mood, sleep, and anxiety. For example, they have animal models mark decrease in territoriality and aggressive behavior when their diets were supplemented with tryptophan, and humans experience similar results. For example, in studies of adults who are self-described as quarrelsome, 1,000 milligrams of tryptophan 3 times a day produced significant increases in measures of agreeableness and agreeable behaviors, and decreases in negative behavior, like being argumentative. Interestingly, men in one study experienced a reduction in dominance, whereas both men and women experienced a decrease in arguing and an increase in behavior that was considered agreeable. So that's important. There was a study of 10-year-old boys with elevated physical aggressiveness. Typically, you know, they'd be on medications, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor, Ritalin. But they benefited from a single 500 milligram dose of tryptophan. In the supplementing group, boys were able to adjust their level of response based upon the level of provocation, helping them avoid violent encounters. They were also able to make them more mature perspectives and be able to be helpful in the group. All behaviors that could be achieved by many older adults as well. Now, there are other studies that have demonstrated that low levels of tryptophan can have a negative effect on behavior. Patients receiving interferon therapy against hepatitis C infection, for example, experienced decreases in plasma tryptophan levels. And as a result, those undergoing that therapy are notoriously likely to experience emotional irritability and severe depression as side effects. And another example, mice lacking the gene necessary to convert tryptophan to serotonin display extreme compulsive and impulsive behavior, including intense aggressiveness. So people with naturally impulsive or aggressive personalities may receive the most benefit from supplementing with tryptophan. So that is the good. So what can we do? What's our takeaway message? The takeaway message is that if you're finding yourself in moods, and aggressive, and pain, anxiety, and sleep problems, and memory problems, eating problems, addictive behavior, endocrine dysregulation, motor behavior, tryptophan can make a difference, even just getting a good night's sleep. Now, the two main biomolecules that are involved in the production of normal sleep, the neurotransmitter serotonin and the hormone melatonin. Now, both are naturally made from tryptophan in the body. That makes tryptophan a tremendously valuable supplement for those whose sleep is lacking in either quality or quantity. And they show between 1 to 15 grams of tryptophan at bedtime can help you fall asleep. Even doses as little as 250 milligrams are found to increase the quality of sleep by lengthening the amount of time spent in the deepest stages of sleep. And a lot of studies show 1,000 milligrams, that's 1 gram, of tryptophan at bedtime significantly improves sleepiness. You go to sleep, you stay asleep, and that's all good. It helps manage depression. It should be used with depression. And as with sleep disturbances, depression can contribute to irritability, impulsive behavior, and poor judgment. And for at least 30 years, tryptophan has been recognized as the neurotransmitter of central importance in managing depression. And virtually all drug therapies in use today aim at raising levels of serotonin at the synapses where nerve cells communicate. Now, boosting and balancing brain serotonin through tryptophan, as opposed to drug therapy, is the best approach, especially with the discovery that patients with major depression have low levels of tryptophan. And studies have shown that tryptophan compares favorably with prescription antidepressants, but you don't end up with any of the negative effects. So that's very important, because we have an awful lot of people that could use help. It can reduce anxiety. It can reduce stress. And it also helps relieve PMS. Most people know B6 does. Yes, it does. But you can also get the benefits from tryptophan as well. If you just don't have enough serotonin, or you're out of balance of serotonin, you can end up with behavioral problems, aggression, sleep disorders, mania, all kinds of problems. So get some help. Next up, vitamin C. Two botanical compounds. One is called piperine, P-I-P-E-R-I-N-E, and the other is called dihydroquercetin, D-I, hydro, H-Y-D-R-O, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. They can both help increase the utilization of vitamin C. Now, piperine, I've spoken about it before. It's an alkaloid found in black pepper, and I've told you black pepper is just absolutely wonderful for us, and it significantly speeds up vitamin C's absorption of the bloodstream. And piperine has also been shown to increase absorption of various nutrients, such as curcumin, because it alters the characteristics of the cell lining the digestive tracts, and therefore you're getting better vitamin C utilization. And dihydroquercetin is a potent flavonoid molecule found in grape leaf extracts, and it optimizes vitamin C through mechanisms of action entirely different from piperine. Like all antioxidants, vitamin C is used up in the process of scavenging toxic reactive oxygen and nitrogen species. In scientific terms, active vitamin C reduces oxidant molecules by donating electrons, thereby becoming oxidized and hence inactive itself. But dihydroquercetin has been shown to donate electrons back to those oxidized vitamin C molecules, essentially make them brand new in generating their ability to combat oxidative damage in cells and plasma. So that's why I've always suggested take your quercetin with vitamin C. And oxidative damage is a major problem for heart, can create heart disease and strokes. And it's a pro-inflammatory, so that's one of the reasons that you want to take your quercetin and vitamin C. It can also help prevent cancer. So what's our takeaway message? Takeaway message is this. We all need vitamin C throughout the day, not just once. I suggest 8 times. Vitamin C is essential for 8 major enzyme systems on which life depends. In addition to its enzyme activity, vitamin C's antioxidant properties facilitate thousands of beneficial biochemical reactions. So when you're combining vitamin C with other nutrients, it aids in boosting the rate of absorption of in the intestine and recharging vitamin C. And that can help lower your risk of cancer, kills off E. pylori, Helicobacter in the stomach that can cause ulcers. It can help you prevent diabetes. It can strengthen with 1,000 milligrams a day. It can strengthen your immune system and prevent or decrease the severity of colds and flu. It can prevent lung disease. That's big. And when you consider lung tissue naturally bears the brunt of continuous oxidant assaults in the body, with oxidant damage triggering inflammation in the lungs, a protective reflex called bronchospasm occurs, which we experience as asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Studies show that vitamin C levels are lower in asthmatic patients. So the more problems with your lung, the more vitamin C you need. It also helps protect our bones and causes mineralization. So vitamin C is good. Take it in the right way, and it becomes even better. One last thing, cinnamon is really a superstar. Putting some cinnamon in your health drink, wow. Just so many things that cinnamon does. It is one of the best antioxidants there is, having one of the highest ORAC protective effects. Even the U.S. National Library of Medicine shows over 1,300 abstracts on cinnamon's helpful beneficial effect. So get your cinnamon. It can thin your blood, but not like aspirin that can kill you. It doesn't. It can help you with having all forms of problems with bacteria because it's strongly protective of your throat. It fights off infection. Now, few people realize that cinnamon has been confirmed to have extensive anti-infective properties against a wide range of bacteria, viruses, fungi. So anytime you're feeling under the weather, you're going to travel, take a nice tea, a green tea with about a quarter teaspoon of cinnamon in there. It's been shown to kill Aspergillus niger, Campylobacter, Candida, coronavirus, E. coli, H1N1. It has done wonderful things, and that's all good. That's the latest on health nutrition. That takes us through the first 23 minutes of our program. Now, as this is called Talk Back, your turn to call in and share your points of view, your questions, your concerns, the issues that you find important. So take advantage of this. The number to call in on is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And to listen anywhere in Canada, in the United States, by telephone. So you never miss a show. You never have to worry about there being so many people trying to get on board that you can't squeeze in, even though, by the way, that whole problem is being corrected. We're even going to another serving company to get us the largest server we can, because we're expecting millions of people to be listening in this coming next 12 months. Call this number, 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. That way you can listen and you don't miss anything. Just to give you an idea, I was not aware of the figures, but when people couldn't get on board, they started calling that number. And we had what's called unique listeners. Those are brand new. And just in one, I think, 22-minute segment, we had almost 10,000. But last month, people listening over the phone was over 486,000. 486,000. Let me put that in perspective. If you took all five Pacifica stations and all 860 programs, this is double that in listenership. Back in a moment with your calls, and we still have more things coming at you. Lots of information today. All powerful to heal, to help, to empower you. Please stay with us.
There's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what's wrong? You just a fool, you know you're in love. What you say? You got to face it to live in a smile. You take a fool. Sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad. One more time. You know you love him, you can't understand.
It's nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take your calls in a moment from our environmental segment. This is from Common Dreams. The energy chief confirms critics' worst fears. Obama still loves coal. According to his Secretary of Energy, they're touting the myth of clean coal as their foremost energy strategy. Quote, U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz declared that, quote, coal is our future, affirming skeptics' fears despite the rhetoric heralded in President Obama's climate policy speech. The U.S. will continue to kowtow to the interests of big coal. The energy chief's statement appeared to backpedal on comments made by the president regarding, quote, new rules to cut carbon emissions. Despite these claims, Obama, quote, expects fossil fuels and coal specifically to remain a significant contributor for some time. And he said here, quote, rather than moving away from fossil fuels, Obama's administration keeps pinning its hopes on developing new technologies to make coal cleaner. The plan is in rough form, involves collecting carbon dioxide emitted by power plants and burying it forever underground. It sounds like a heck of a challenge. Yeah, does it? Well, to tell you how bad it is, they've given an $8 billion loan guarantee for a project to develop clean coal. So much for feeding a single homeless kid or stopping a single family from being thrown out on the street. But they got $8 billion for their buddies in the coal industry. And don't forget, if you ever did your homework and went back and saw what were the actual legal issues and legal projects that Obama had before he became a state legislator, it was for the coal industry also. I believe that our entire judicial system has been corrupted completely, and it will not be uncorrupted. This is just one aspect of this. Quote, Supreme Court rules drug companies exempt from lawsuits. Washington, in case you missed it with all the coverage of other court rulings recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has made a ruling on lawsuits against drug companies for fraud, mislabeling, side effects, and accidental deaths. From now on, 80% of all drugs are exempt from legal liability. In a 5-4 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a lower court's ruling and award for the victim of a pharmaceutical drug's adverse reactions. According to the victim and the state courts, the drug caused a flesh-eating side effect that left the patient permanently disfigured over most of her body. The adverse reaction was hidden by the drug maker and later forced to be included on a warning label. But the highest court in the land ruled that the victim had no legal grounds to sue the corporation because its drugs are exempt from lawsuits. How that happened is called lobbying. You pay enough for the lobbyist, you get the results. I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea that we should recycle, and indeed we should. But a lot of people believe as long as we recycle, we don't have to pay attention to what we consume. I disagree with that. According to George Monbiot of The Guardian, every society has topics it does not discuss. These are the issues which challenge its comfortable assumptions. They're the ones that remind us of morality, which threaten the continuity of we anticipate, which expose our various beliefs as wrong. Now, among them are the facts which sink the cozy assertion that we can go forward, keep growing, keep consuming, but not have to be concerned. I deal with that all the time on this program. Well, at a recent London reception, George Monbiot met an extremely wealthy woman who lives as most people with similar levels of wealth do, in an almost comically unsustainable fashion, jetting between various homes and resorts in one long turbocharged holiday. So when he asked her about what she was doing, And then he explained that he, you know, he talks on environmental issues. She says, quote, "Oh, I agree. The environment is so important. I'm crazy about recycling," end quote. But the real problem, she explained, was, quote, "people breeding too much." I see. As an aside, are you talking about Donald Trump breeding too much? Who, wealthy hedge fund owners? Who are you? Are you talking about poor people? Or people of color? Or people of a low economic standard breeding too much? I'm sure that you're not challenging nobility breeding. Why not? I agree that population is an element of the problem, but the idea that consumption is rising much faster, and unlike the growth in the number of people, it's showing no signs of leveling off. The woman found this notion deeply offensive. I mean, the notion that human population growth is slowing. When I told her that, quote, "birth rates are dropping almost everywhere and that the world is undergoing a slow demographic transition," she disagreed violently. She has seen on her endless travels how many children, quote, "all those people have." As so many in her position do, she was using population as a means of disavowing her own impacts. The issue allowed her to transfer responsibility to others, people at the opposite end of the economic spectrum. It allowed her to pretend that her shopping and flying and endless refurbishments of her multiple homes are not a problem. Recycling and population, these are the amulets people clasp in order not to see the clash between protecting the environment and rising consumption. In a similar way, we have managed, with the help of a misleading global accounting system, to overlook one of the gravest impacts of our consumption. This, too, has allowed us to blame foreigners, particularly poor foreigners, for the problem. When nations negotiate global cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, they are held responsible only for the gases produced within their own boundaries. Partly as a result of this convention, these tend to be the only ones that countries count. When these territorial emissions fall, they congratulate themselves on reducing their carbon footprints. But as markets all over the world in all kinds have been globalized, and as manufacturing migrates from rich nations to poorer nations, territorial accounting bears ever less relationship to real impacts. Now, what do I mean by that in lay language? Well, this is an issue which affects all post-industrial countries. It's especially pertinent in the United Kingdom and the United States, where the difference between our domestic and international impacts is greater than that of any other major emitter. The last government boasted that this country cut greenhouse gases a little bit, but it just moved those out of the country. And so when you become a nation that consumes, not just manufactures, then you still are consuming things that are going to be thrown away, that will not biodegrade down. Think of all the plastic. But if we had 58,000 factories that closed in the last 12 years in the United States, putting millions of people out of work, that lowers the carbon footprint somewhat. Yes, it does. But then you move those factories to China and India. They manufacture, pollute their countries with no safety. I mean, all those countries are just a disgrace when it comes to their so-called democracy, especially India. It's just a total fraud of a democracy. It's corrupt at every level and racist at every level. They're untouchable concepts. In any case, aside from all the stupidity that they only know stupid. They don't know anything other than stupid, manipulative, greedy, power, corruption, influence peddling, and individual profit. But at the end of the day, what you have is you have two of the world's largest number of poor people living in abject poverty, completely cut off from real services or care. You're dealing with over 2 billion people in China and India combined who are left out, but their countries are manufacturing, so those products that they make cheaply can be brought back in the United States, and we consume them. Where do you think your computer and your cell phone, where do you think everything you consume goes when you've used it? It becomes part of our pollution. So we're really doing nothing functional in order to reduce our emissions. and we're doing nothing to stop consuming. We still pride ourselves on how much we can buy. Whether we can afford it or not, need it or not, is immaterial. Whether it's good for us or bad for us is irrelevant. All that's important is either I've got cash or credit card, either I can pay for it out of savings or create debt, but I want what I want when I want it, and I'm going to consume it. If I get overweight, if I get diseased, if I get cancer, I can blame someone else for it. I'll take no responsibility for my predicament. That is what most Americans are dealing with today. Next up, children. Children in the United States, children around the world. Now, anyone who has a brain knows that the entire ADHD and ADD and mental illness in children is a complete and total fabricated fraud by the pharmaceutical industrial complex working hand in glove with a completely faux, fake, fraudulent so-called medical science called psychiatry. Because rebalancing your brain chemistry through their drugs doesn't work, hasn't worked, and won't work. They have no science on their side. But they have an audience. And as long as they can pump billions of dollars in advertising, they can make most Americans believe that something's wrong with them or something's wrong with their children. And they got backup, the school teachers, the principals, the school psychologists, how quick they are to judge. Jimmy's looking out the window. Jimmy's fidgeting. Jimmy's not paying attention. Jimmy must have ADHD. Jimmy, go to the principal, then go to the school psychologist, then go to the psychiatrist, get on your Ritalin. What you don't use, you can sell illegally to the other kids at lunch. It's the number one illegal drug sold in school campuses. They crush up the Ritalin and sell it. But we won't talk about that. That makes us be reflective. And if there's one thing Americans aren't, is reflective. So in comes Dr. Marilyn Wedge in Psychology Today. Quote, why French kids don't have ADHD? In the United States, at least 9%, go up to 15% in young boys. And you'll see the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. That should also be in your article. And you have all these kids diagnosed with ADHD. And they're taking pharmaceutical medications. In France, the percentage of kids diagnosed and medicated for ADHD is less than 0.5%, one-tenth, or one-and-a-half of 1%. How come the epidemic of ADHD, which has become firmly established in the United States, has almost completely passed over children in France? Is ADHD a biological, neurological disorder? Surprisingly, the answer to this question depends upon whether you live in France or the United States. In the United States, child psychiatrists consider ADHD to be a biological disorder with biological causes. The preferred treatment is also biological, psychostimulant medications like Ritalin and Adderall. French child psychiatrists, on the other hand, view ADHD as a medical condition that has psychosocial and situational causes. Instead of treating children focusing on behavioral problems with drugs, French doctors prefer to look for the underlying issue that is causing the child's distress, not in the child's brain, but in the child's social context. Then they choose to treat the underlying social context problem with psychotherapy or family counseling. This is a very different way of seeing things from the American tendency to attribute all symptoms to a biological dysfunction such as a chemical imbalance in the child's brain. French child psychiatrists don't use the same system of classification of childhood emotional problems as American psychiatrists. They do not use the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. According to sociologist Manuel Valle, the French Federation of Psychiatry developed an alternative classification system as a resistance to the influence of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. This alternative was released first in 1983, and to the extent that the French clinicians are successful at finding and repairing what has gone wrong in the child's social context, fewer children qualify for the ADHD diagnosis. Moreover, the definition of ADHD is not as broad as in the American system. The French holistic psychosocial approach also allows for considering nutrition causes, specifically the fact that the behavior of some children is worsened by eating foods with artificial colors, certain preservatives, and allergens. Clinicians who work with troubled children in this country, not to mention parents of many ADHD kids, are well aware that dietary interventions can sometimes help a child's problem. In the United States, the strict focus on pharmaceutical treatment of ADHD, however, encourages clinicians to ignore the influence of dietary factors on children's behavior. And then, of course, there are the vastly different philosophies of child rearing in the United States and France. These divergent philosophies could account for why French children are generally better behaved than their American counterparts. Pamela Drunkerman highlights the divergent parenting values in her recent book, Bringing Up Baby. I believe her insights are relevant to a discussion of why French children are not diagnosed with ADHD in anything like the numbers we're seeing in the United States. From the time the children are born, French parents provide them with a firm cadre, the word frame and structure. Children are not allowed, for example, to snack whenever they want. Meal times are at 4 specific times a day. French children learn to wait patiently for meals rather than eating snack foods whenever they feel like it. And French parents love their children just as much as American parents. They give them piano lessons, take them to sports practice, and encourage them to make the most of their talents. But French parents have a different philosophy of discipline, consistently enforced limits. In the way French view it, it makes the child feel safe and secure. Clear limits, they believe, actually make a child feel happier and safer, and something that is congruent with my own experience as both a therapist and a parent. And finally, French parents believe that hearing the word no rescues children from the tyranny of their own desires. So, as a therapist who works with children, it makes perfect sense to me that French children don't need medications to control their behavior because they learn self-control early in their lives. Let me repeat that. The children in France learn self-control. The children grow up in families in which the rules are well understood and a clear family hierarchy is firmly in place. In French families, parents are firmly in charge of their kids instead of the American family style, in which the situation is also frequently reversed. End quote, Dr. Marilyn Wedge from Psychology Today. I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's see who's up there. Let's say hello to, is it Jada from Vermont?
Yes. Hi.
Hi, Jada.
Hi. I wanted to know, I know at some point you had talked about creating an artisan's village, and I wanted to know if you still plan to do that, and also what do you see the role of artists, the role of artists, I guess since they're not really given, they're not really honored in our time right now. I wanted to know if you recommend, if you think people should still become artisans, work as potters and try to create those skills, because I see so many people abandoning these. They're wonderful artists. I have friends who are wonderful artists, but they're abandoning these skills because they don't have money and they're going mm-hmm. back to school into things that I just think it's
okay,
a shame.
Okay, let me take a crack at this. I believe that if you're a very high-end artist financially, like a Peter Max, then art is great for you. But for almost all other artisans, it's not, and it's going to get worse. However, the reason that I am creating, as we speak, an artisan's village, in fact, we're going to have a meeting on this where Luann Panessi will be selecting the people for our upcoming homestead project to actually be a part of an artisan's village. We're going to start with 10, is because I believe that you can take your experience as an artist, whether it's a glassblower or a weaver or a goldsmith, silversmith, or it's a fine painter, to those people around the world who would benefit tremendously, would love to be able to learn, but doing it from their home. So bringing the people to the artisan's studio and letting the artist be a teacher, that's what I see the future as being. Secondly, so many artists are also strong social activists. They're deeply impassioned by what they see as injustices. And almost every major cause is given its moniker by the artist who will create the songs or the poems or the flags or the caricatures that allow it to be identified. And so having a place where artisans can also be engaged in social activities and is crucial for the future, just for the satisfaction of the heart energy, knowing you're doing something good. So combining those two is the key, and doing it with other people is essential. The days of everyone hunkering down in their own hovels and assuming that that's okay, the economy is changing. I just had a long conversation with one of America's foremost artists and art promoters. He's a professor in art, and he's an artist himself. But he did something wonderful with the last 15 years. He helped gather so many of the people who are artisans in the greater tri-state area, but mainly in Newark, and he opened up this huge factory, free rent, and they had to move recently because the city did something with the building, but it was a way of helping promote that art. That's gone now. That's not coming back. People don't have the money for it as they once did. It does mean people should give up on being an artist. It means they have to do it in a different way. They should do it together. I believe that there are going to be Artisans Village all over the world because they have a different way of looking at problems and solutions and still maintaining the unique qualities of their skilled set, whatever it may be. So we're going to have a meeting on this next week. Let's go over to Luann Panessi and say hello to her. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, I'm getting a lot of emails this week about the situation in Syria. And we now have, yesterday, Barack Obama decided that he wants to get, he says, well, I believe I have the authority to carry out this military action without specific congressional authorization. I know the country will be stronger if we take this course. And that is to meet with Congress. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of your audience, meanwhile, all over the Internet, by the way, are plastered pictures of these gassed children, a lot of pictures of young children and families just gassed to death, or chemically, you know, they use that chemical. And, of course, your audience is turning to you and asking for you to lead the progressive voices in your audience to a better understanding and what your take is on this whole situation in Syria.
All right. Well, first, I don't see how we become better by telling the Syrians, Syrians, you better stop killing each other because we're going to come in and show you a lesson. We're going to kill you. I somehow that missed me in logic 101. Next, what are the real reasons? Yes, there was a massacre, but who was responsible? I have seen no compelling evidence that it was the Syrian government, but I have seen a great deal of evidence that it was probably the Saudi Arabian security services that are the primary funders through their vast resources and never challenged for any of their crimes against humanity, whether it's crimes against women, which is endemic in Saudi Arabia, or against the Shia. The Shia are a minority in the Sunnis, and especially the most radical form of Sunni, and these are the Sunnis that are make up an enormous amount of the terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda. So what you have is you have no clear evidence. But if this is the same government that says, trust us, we have evidence, is this the same government that says, trust us, we have absolute evidence that the Tonkin Gulf happened, the incident, and then that we should get into this conflict because we have the evidence? Did I miss something? Wasn't it Colin Powell who lied before the UN, but with absolute confidence, with the head of the CIA behind him, of weapons of mass destruction? Virtually all those photographs he showed were fraudulent There were no weapons of mass destruction. How about the in 1990, the pretext for going into a conflict with Iraq over its invasion of its neighbor for its oil reserves? It was all about babies being thrown out of incubators on the floor, but it actually didn't happen. It later turned out the person who released that story was the daughter of an ambassador, and she worked for a public relations firm that was handling the pro-war effort. And Susan Rice lied by telling the world that Libyan loyalist troops were being issued Viagra and instructed to commit mass rapes. It was a lie. So virtually everything we do is a lie. We haven't told the truth about anything in such a long time. But if you tell someone that we're living in a totalitarian police state and you accuse this regime, both Democrats and Republicans, they're all sociopaths, in my opinion, of doing anything on purpose, they'll say, well, how's that possible? And I remind them, remember the 3.5 million that have been killed and all the millions displaced and the people with birth defects because of Vietnam? That all happened from one of the biggest lies and proven lies. And it was all about the U.S. Navy on August 2nd. The vessel attacked Vietnamese craft in their own waters. And then the U.S. turned around and claimed that they were attacked. And then from that series of lies, it was an operation called Oplan 34A, O-P-L-A-N. And it was the Tonkin Gulf Resolution that was drafted by the Johnson administration. And then later, Freedom of Information Act showed that the military officials and President Johnson met in Honolulu 2 months prior to the incident taking place. That meant that the Johnson administration already intended to widen the war and that was going on. And then they carried out with USS Maddox this and gave all these naval reports about having dodged torpedoes and taken shells and all this. All of it was a lie. Not a single word was true. So Johnson then ordered airstrikes. And McNamara, Robert McNamara, one of the worst sociopathic murderers in history, lied to Congress. Then he couldn't tell the truth. He ended up running the World Bank. Great place for lying sociopaths. I don't know if they have a capability of hiring anyone, except they hired Wolfowitz. Of course, if you're really a lowlife, you'll end up at the World Bank. In any case, McNamara lied to Congress, told them that both the destroyers had been attacked, and that secured the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. All lies. So Vietnam, lies. Going into Panama, lies. Going in to take out Gaddafi, lies. So we don't actually know who's behind the chemical weapons attack. And a military strike would be illegal under the U.S. Constitution, the War Powers Resolution, irrespective of what the president says. And it also violates international law. And more Americans are opposing it. And exactly how we teaching them a lesson than when we are the nation that is using depleted uranium. We are the ones that sold white phosphorus munitions to Israel, and they used it. And then we used it in Iraq and in Basra, which is a weapons of mass destruction. So the hypocrisy is palpable. And where exactly can you benefit from hitting a target without killing people? And if you detonate one of their chemical or biological weapons depots, you've just put it all over the place. And then suddenly you're tipping the balance so that the Al-Qaeda and the terrorist and the religious zealots who want Sharia law, they will come to power. And then you have another Libya and you have another Iraq. So just think of all the things that could go wrong, and then tell me one thing that has ever gone right since World War II that we've done. Can you name me a single military intervention that went right? No.
My opinion? No way.
Yeah. So those are the things I would say. Keep protesting. Don't accept anything that the government tells you. They don't know how to tell you the truth. And this is the same government that has decided that we the people are not to be trusted. We the people, especially if we protest war, then we are no better than terrorists in their minds. That we shouldn't have the... if you're a journalist, you no longer are protected by the First Amendment from your sources. So they've eviscerated the First Amendment. They've eviscerated the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, habeas corpus. They spy on you. They read every single email. They listen to every single phone call. And now they can watch over television. The new technology allows them complete access. So these are the people that lied about all that. But somehow on this, we're supposed to believe them. I'm sure there will be people who need to believe them. Redemption of their own worthless lives by believing in people who have never told the truth. And I don't know any of the people in power who've ever told the truth. Do you?
No.
No. The very need for people to have power over other people shows you're dealing with pathologically dysfunctional individuals. Every member of Congress, every member of the judiciary, every lobbyist, every lawyer, every one in the White House should all be on 17 million units of Prozac a day. then we would have them under control.
Throw in some Thorazine, too.
Yeah. We don't want to cause erectile dysfunction. That'd take away their life. Thank you a lot, Lou Impanesi. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening.